Welcome to the Modern Spirituality Show. I'm Ben Decker, and I'm here with one of my favorite people in the world, and I really mean that. This is Light Watkins. He's a meditation teacher, prolific author, guide, great guy, really knows his stuff. And we're here today talking about his fourth book. Is this your fourth book, Light?
Fourth book, yep.
Wow. Well, welcome.
Number four.
Travel Light. Travel Light. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me and for making the time from Central America.
Yeah, you know, it's my absolute pleasure. And when I heard you had your next book coming out, I was like, I've got to do everything I can to let everybody know about this epic book. Look, everything that you've written, I know that for you, it's not about not knocking out another book. It's really about being with the content, really being with the material before it comes out. So I know everything that you've written is always really well thought out and thorough and beautiful. And I love this idea in Travel Light as spiritual minimalism. And so I know a little bit about the adventure that brought you into that, but I'd love to hear you share a little bit about your backpacking years.
They're still kind of happening. I mean, I'm posted up here in Mexico City, where I've been for a couple of years. I'm staying in this really nice Airbnb in the expat area of town, which is really beautiful. But everything that I personally own still fits in my backpack. So when I do travel, which I often do, back to the States or wherever else I'm going for retreats or trainings or talks or panels, I just take my backpack, my little day pack. And so all of that started in 2018 when I was we were living in Los Angeles. I was in Santa Monica. I'm not sure where exactly you were living in 2018. In Venice. Okay. So we were not that far from each other. I was actually right off of Rose Avenue. So technically, I was like on the border of Venice and Santa Monica. So in some interviews, people may hear me say Venice. In other interviews, they may hear me say Santa Monica, but it's kind of the same.
Right.
And I got the call, man. I got the call to get rid of all of my stuff and to start living out of a carry-on bag. And some of my inspirations, this is around probably 2016, 17, when I got the call initially. I had friends who had been traveling nomadically. I saw the Minimalists documentary, and that was inspiring. And I also was inspired by Ram Dass for some strange reason. I saw his documentary, and I heard about Wayne Dyer giving up all of his stuff and when he moved to Hawaii. And I was just, and that was all just like, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson has this quote: "Our chief want is for someone to inspire us to be what we know we can be." And so I would say those were my inspirations to move forward with the inner calling, but the calling itself came from within. I don't know why. I don't know what the end result was supposed to be, except that I recognized that I reached a point within myself that I said, you know what? Okay, I'm going to do this. I actually made a vow a long, long time ago when I was like 29 years old, that I was going to follow my heart relentlessly. And so whenever I had these urges to take a leap of faith, I was, you know, I'm normal. I'm a normal person. I don't like interrupting my comfort zone any more than anyone else does. But I also understand that, you know, it's like the Star Wars film when Luke's home gets destroyed and he has no choice really but to go and study the Force with Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, we all have that moment where if we try to hold on to it, the universe destroys the comfort zone. So when you recognize that things are starting to get, you know, taken apart, which started happening, because I initially resisted and I was like, you know, I'll do it, but I'll do it when it's convenient to do it, when life slows down and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I started having these run-ins with my landlord, which never happened before. Broke up with my girlfriend, felt kind of lonely in the apartment, and just started feeling more and more disconnected with Los Angeles. And so I said, okay, this is it. This is the time. I put in my 30-day notice. That made it real. And then I had 30 days to get rid of everything. And so, and that was good because you don't have a lot of time to go back and forth. Oh, should I get rid of the yearbook? No, you have 30 days. So to get rid of 4 decades worth of stuff. And so I needed all of that time. And on the last day, I rolled out of my old apartment with my new carry-on bag apartment. And I've been nomadic ever since.
Wow. That's huge. I mean, I just went through that moment where I had to get rid of everything, went through a breakup, moved to another country. And I have to commend you, man. I mean, going down to one carry-on, I went down to a 4-piece luggage set, which I was pretty proud of. But I love the way that you've taken that experience, your actual, you know, practical experience of actually traveling light, and use it as a spiritual metaphor in the new book.
Yeah, it was, again, I didn't have language for any of this. When I first rolled out in my new carry-on bag apartment, the term spiritual minimalism was not in my awareness. And, but the more I traveled, and I probably went around the earth 3 or 4 times in those 5 years, and the more I traveled, the more I realized that I was pretty good at not holding on to things that I felt from within were no longer relevant for me. That's what spiritual minimalism means, is minimalism from the inside out, minimalism informed by your spirit. So people may hear about my story and think, oh, I don't want to live in a backpack. That guy has nothing to teach me. Or I don't want to be a minimalist. I like my stuff, and that guy has nothing to teach me. But spiritual minimalism is not about getting rid of anything externally. It's about clearing the internal clutter. And you can't tell me you don't have internal clutter. You can't tell me you don't have emotional baggage that is still distorting your perception and inhibiting your ability to be present in this moment. And so the more that we can get rid of, the more spaciousness, the more fulfillment, the more inner peace we'll start to have. And that will start to inform the choices that you're making right now in real time. Why you're deciding to relate to the people you're relating to, why you're deciding to work at the job you're working at, why you're deciding to take on the projects you're taking on. And maybe you're taking those things on because you think that somewhere down the line, it's going to make you happy. That's the external approach to happiness, the achievement approach to happiness, which all that means is you will get happy. You will get a wave of joy for about a week, and then you'll be right back where you were after that, right back on the treadmill, trying to find the next thing to make you happy. So what they've been saying in spiritual traditions for thousands of years is that there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. And that's what spiritual minimalism is. It's stoking the fire of happiness within so that you can still engage in the project, the relationship, and the job, but you don't need to in order to be happy, which gives you all kinds of freedom.
I love that. Yeah. So I'm wondering, I'm hearing this and I'm like, woo. I mean, that sounds like a lot, right? I mean, you start to think about experiences. We want to feel like we've moved, requires us to live as if we've moved beyond them, but we don't always really release that baggage, that resentment or the attachments to different things, you know? So what are some of the things that you discovered about yourself there, especially at the beginning? What were some of the things that you were surprised that you didn't need, that you had been holding on to?
Interesting. So about 6 months into my journey, I realized I had too much shit. Even though I'd only had a carry-on bag, I was still too much because I wasn't using most of it. And it's easy to forget that you have too much stuff if you have closets in a storage room and space underneath your bed and in your cupboards. If you're carrying everything you have around with you everywhere you go, you're reminded every time you move somewhere of all the stuff you have. And so I downsized to a backpack shortly after moving into my carry-on bag. And then I still realized I had too much stuff. And then I downsized to a day pack. And again, people may look at that and go, oh, that's really extreme. But it's only extreme if you're comparing yourself to having tons and tons, the same version of you with tons and tons of space to store stuff that you may only use once a year. But if you're carrying everything around with you, A, it makes you way more present to wherever you are because you're taking your home with you everywhere you go. And then B, you can have a more accurate assessment of the things that you actually use and the things you don't use and the things you can use for multiple purposes. So you get really creative and clever. You know, my dad and my brother spent some time in prison, federal prison, over the last few years for some white collar stuff. And they would tell me prison stories, you know, and they were in minimum security prison. So it was more like a dormitory, but they would tell me the kind of things that these guys would make in microwaves and the way they would work out and the way they would clean stuff. I mean, prisoners are by far the most innovative people probably in our society because they have to be. They don't have anything. They don't have any of the conveniences, but they find a way to do everything that they need and to sort of normalize that environment. And while none of us would wish that we were experiencing that prison environment, you kind of are if you are attached to things in order to be happy. If you need your espresso machine in order to be happy, if you need this type of blanket in order to be happy, if you need this particular temperature in order to be happy, you know, and so when you start stripping away, you start to see, oh, wow, I was really, really attached to these things. And then if you take it back further, you may find that, you know, there were some instances in childhood or as a teenager where you didn't have the things that you thought you needed for school or for whatever. And you swore to yourself, I'm never going to be in this situation again. I'm going to make sure I have more than enough. And so that began to inform this habit of getting more things and trying to control your environment as much as possible. And so there's a reason why we have a lot of stuff that we don't use. And it's not because it was on sale. It's because there's something happening inside of us that could potentially be still playing out. And so that was something that I got a chance to sort of work through, like looking at what do I really, really need in on the road? And it's surprising. I was shocked, in fact, at how little I found that I needed and how much I didn't miss my house or my stuff or my yearbooks or my scrapbooks or my journals or my cards and letters and plants. And those were really the most sentimental things that I had, but how that got replaced with a higher degree of presence. And then I started to realize, oh, there's sentimental stuff happening all around me when I'm present to it. Wow. So by holding on to grandma's old china set, what you're basically saying is my best days are behind me. And everything that's happening right now and tomorrow aren't going to be nearly as good as that old china set. I beg to differ. I think if you have a strong connection with a stranger because you're present at a fast food restaurant, that styrofoam plate and that plastic fork can be as sentimental as grandma's china set that you never pulled out before. It's just sitting in some closet somewhere collecting dust. And guess what? I would argue that grandma would rather you cherish that connection in the fast food restaurant more so than the china set that she didn't even use.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, especially once they're on the other side, you know, and once they're living in the ancestral realm, especially, it's like
in the eternal. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if, you know, my grandma left me this table that she didn't leave it to me. She died and we all divvied up her stuff. And I got this table because I had this memory of her teaching me how to play cards on it. And one of the things that she did that was really special about how she would play cards was she would read the signs in the cards. So she's playing solitaire, but she's reading the cards as if they were tarot cards. And that was a really important memory for me. And so when the table was there, I was like, that's the table my Mormon grandma taught me how to read tarot cards on it. I'm keeping that table. And the time came to get rid of it. And when it was time, I could feel her presence. And she was like, remember me. Remember me. Just remember that moment. Are you going to forget that moment if you don't have the table? No, you're not. You don't need the table.
That's so beautiful. And it kind of, when I was hearing you tell that story, it reminded me of another takeaway from this journey. Because I have those kinds of things too, you know, where items link back to memories with special people in my life. And even like books, you know, books, it wasn't hard for me to get rid of my books, but I definitely felt connected to those books because they facilitated moments of insight. But then I thought to myself,
right,
these books are just sitting in my closet and they could be enlightening other people. And so, yeah, if you're using the table, if you're using grandma's chair, if you're reading those books over and over, by all means, keep them and keep using them and keep appreciating them for what they're giving you, right? But if they're collecting dust somewhere, and someone else could be enjoying that table and using it and getting some of grandma's good energy, even if they've never met her before, mm-hmm. then I think the table would actually be happier being used than sitting around collecting dust. Secondly, mm-hmm. what that also means is that every piece of furniture, every item, inanimate and animate, surrounding us has a story. So when you're at a hotel room, you're not just in some room with, you know, with objects that are not sentient. Those walls literally can talk. That bed can talk. That chair can talk. And again, that brings more of a sense of aliveness to wherever you are. And you can connect with that, you know, you can connect with that. And if you're also doing your inner work on top of that, you're leaving that space better than you found it. Maybe the last few people that entered into that space were complainers and they kind of left some negative energy. You can feel that if you're sensitive to it. So then you have an opportunity there to leave it better than you found it. You do your meditations in there, you do your gratitudes in there, you do your affirmations in there, and same furniture, same room, different energy. And you can do that everywhere you go, right? So again, this is about cultivating a sense of present moment awareness, because everywhere you go, there you are, right? It's kind of mm-hmm. like what Robert Persick, the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, said. He said, the only Zen you're going to find at the top of the mountain is the Zen you bring up there with you. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you're miserable at the bottom of the mountain and you switch back and make your way up to the top, you're going to be at this beautiful, you know, this beautiful summit, miserable, with a little bit of appreciation for some of the flowers and some of the scenery. But that misery that you still have in you is prohibiting you from fully, fully experiencing the peace that you could otherwise have at that place. Or if you're peaceful inside and feel zen, you could be in a post office, you could be in traffic, you can be in Walmart, you could be in line at the grocery store, and you can be having these profound moments of connectivity, either with yourself, with other people, seeing things, feeling things, sensing things that are inspiring you and giving you ideas, and you're making connections between things that seem to be unrelated to most people. And you walk out of that environment like, oh my God, I've got the idea how I'm going to start my book or what I'm going to call my podcast, because you were present to those moments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the things like that you recommend for actually cultivating that deeper sense of presence? You know, you're talking about the literal physical act that you took of actually, you know, selling it. You know, in the Bible, Jesus says, sell everything you have and come follow me. You know, so there's like that physical act of actual surrender that we're talking about. What are some of the things that where can we start?
Okay. So, obviously I'm a big advocate for meditation, as are you. So, I definitely, advocate for daily meditation as a way of connecting with your intuition, which I call your heart voice. But let's say you don't have time to meditate. I get it. You're busy. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's that famous, like, if you don't have 10 minutes to meditate, you need to meditate for an hour.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt, Ben.
Yeah. Okay.
their life is very busy.
Lots of kids in the house, maybe.
Lots of jobs, lots of kids. You don't know what my struggles are like. Yeah. Lots of everything. I get lots of TV, lots of Netflix, lots of episodes you got to watch.
Yeah.
Lots of scrolling you got to do on Instagram. I get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say you don't have time for that. Okay. Think about 10 things you're grateful for. So I don't know if you've heard of this guy named Brad Lee. He's like an internet marketer guy. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he's got this wonderful little thought experiment. He says to someone, if I were to gift you with $10 million, no strings attached, cash, you don't have to pay taxes on it or anything like that, how would that make you feel? Hmm. So I'll do it with you. How would that make you feel if I just handed you $10 million? No strings attached.
Yeah. Okay. So there's $10 million cash, no strings attached. I think it would feel like there's a lot of possibilities.
Okay, perfect.
So a lot of the things that are stressful around money, that would feel like those are off the table now, no longer stressful.
Right. A lot of possibilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe it would feel a little bit good too. Like you feel a little joy around it. Like these things.
It would feel good to not. Yeah, definitely. I think
I can invest. I can save.
I think if good or bad were the things I was working with, I would say good over the $10 million. Yeah, probably.
Okay, perfect. Now his next statement is, okay, there's a catch. The catch is,
you said there was no strings, bro. Okay, whatever. What's the catch?
No. The catch is you have the $10 million. The only caveat is you can't wake up tomorrow. You have one day basically to enjoy the $10 million. Would you still take the $10 million?
I'm going to have to answer that one off the record. there's still so much that could be done good in the universe with $10 million, and there's a.
So chance. You would take one for the team.
There's a chance, depending on where I'm at that day.
this is the problem with talking to spiritual people. You're like, oh, well, you know, life is forever, so it's all good.
I could die tomorrow anyway. Yeah.
Pretend like you're an average person with $10 million.
Of course. Of course not. Of course you wouldn't even have a chance to spend it all or to do all those things. All those stressors, if I'm dying tomorrow, those stressors are gone anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
His point is this. Most people would reject the $10 million if they knew for a fact that they couldn't live beyond 24 hours if they accepted the $10 million, right? So what that is effectively saying is that waking up in the morning, you should have the same energy that you would have if someone handed you $10 million because of all the possibilities. You're basically saying that's worth millions and millions and millions just waking up in the morning. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about gratitude, right, we want to really keep it local. Okay, I woke up. I can see, I can taste, I can hear, I can walk. There are people who can't walk up a flight of stairs ever, who would give millions of dollars to be able to have that experience. There are people who can't see, right? So you're basically are walking around with, you know, you're walking trillionaire in the terms of the things that you can do. And those are things to be grateful for. I know it doesn't sound like it on an average day when things aren't going your way, because you feel like everybody can see and everybody can taste, but actually everybody can. Everybody can. And those are things to appreciate. And so we can just drop in to gratitude around those little things. It can make us, a lot more appreciative of the possibilities that are still there versus focusing on what's not happening. So I would say gratitude should be a go-to practice that you can do while you're scrolling. In fact, do this. and this is going to sound a little bit weird, maybe off to some people, find influencers who have disabilities, who don't have the same capabilities that you have. And I do this too. Like, I follow people who inspire me. Like, I follow this one guy, he has no legs, no arms, but he's giving keynote talks. And every time I see one of his talks, I get inspired. And I'm like, man, I'm so grateful that he exists, that he did the best with what he had, and that it reminds me to do the best with what I have and not focus on what I don't have. If you follow a bunch of people like that, and your scrolling is giving you inspiration, and right, that's like a prayer or meditation almost, just you scrolling through Instagram. So there's all kinds of creative ways that you could drop into that state of gratitude and still live a very normal life. So that's one, I would say, affirmative prayer. There's this idea like toxic positivity, which I don't really understand. I get why people say that, but mm-hmm. What about negativity? Negativity is pretty toxic too. And there's a mm-hmm. lot of that going around, and no one's mm-hmm. saying anything about that. So I think if it's a choice between forcing myself to find something positive about the situation versus just succumbing to what everybody else is saying that's negative about the situation, I'd rather train my mind to see the positive as opposed to the negative. And so one practice is that whenever you feel critical of someone, even of yourself, force yourself lovingly to find something positive to say to that person or about that person, just as a fun little exercise. And what you'll find is that there is an energy associated with the negative comment, and there's an energy associated with the positive comment. The negative comment tends to conjure up funky energy. It doesn't make you feel great when you're talking negatively about somebody. Whereas if you're talking positively about them, and I'm talking about coming up with sincere compliments. Let's say there's a narcissist in your life, just to use a term that everybody's using these days. There's a narcissist in your life, and you know, that person makes everything about themselves. It's so easy to point that out. You're actually not doing anything remarkable by pointing that out if everybody else is pointing that out. But what if you're the person who's in that room and saying, well, you know, he is very giving too. He did give, he did help me out when I was, falling on hard times. He gave me some good advice and words. He connected me with the person that gave me that job. Like, if that's true, then focus on that. Don't focus on the things that he or she has done in their past that's negative, because that's going to shift your energy. Possibly you could even shift the energy in the whole room, and then you're leaving that room better than you found it. So that's the mm-hmm. second thing. And then the third thing is just breathing. When you feel yourself getting anxious, when you feel yourself getting drawn into that negativity, just take 5 or 10 deep breaths. In fact, I've counted all this out. In 1 minute, you can take 6 deep breaths. 1 minute, you can take 6 deep breaths. And if you take those 6 deep breaths every minute on the minute for, say, 5 minutes, you'll be in a completely different energetic state. And if you don't believe me, try it out and you'll see how you feel at the end of those 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes. You could do that while you're driving. You could do it while you're walking. You could do it while you're sitting down watching TV, right? And that's what mm-hmm. spiritual minimalism is doing more with less. You don't have to have separate, you know, times to do all these things. You can integrate them all. And that's what my book, Travel Light, teaches you how to do, is how to integrate affirmations with your exercising. Instead of counting down with numbers, count down with affirmations. Instead of saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, say, I am perfect, whole, complete. Ben is perfect, whole, complete. Next set. Light is perfect, whole, complete. Next set. My mom is perfect, whole, right? And you've got the whole family. You sent them all positive energy. You got your exercise in. You counted down and you did all that in a meditative way, which I guarantee you will leave you feeling more uplifted than if you just were in there not wanting to be there, hating the experience, you know, counting down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then just leaving it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And it's it's making those moments more mean more, doing more with less, like you said. And I'm picturing, like, I'm here in Costa Rica in the rainforest. I'm working out. I've got my whole at home set up over here because there's not an Equinox in the jungle. And I can see how every single moment, the way you think and what your intention is, what you're carrying to every single moment, absolutely changes everything. It absolutely colors the entire thing. It's like when you watch a film. I recently consulted on a film, watched different pieces of it be filmed. I was there for a number of scenes. I was in the editing room watching the raw footage. But then once they put the music over it, cut the edits together, the whole energy is completely different. The music over it is sort of like our attitude and the energy with which we bring to a moment. And if you're listening to this like crazy bodybuilder music where they're like beast mode, ruthless, it's really, really different than if you're thinking, I'm already whole. You know, I'm perfect, whole, and complete, like you said. You know, it's a really different embodiment, that vibration that's like anchoring into those bicep curls or those skull crushers or those crunches or those planks or whatever it is that you're up to. So I love that. Something that I saw, one of the phrases that I saw in your book that I wanted to ask you about is, I know we mentioned, look, if you have any resistance to meditation or you feel like there's no time, like, we're not here to convince you, right? We're trying to meet people where we're at. There's a lot going on in the world. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of hard things that can come up. It's not about making ourselves feel bad for not doing the thing that we, for some reason, have resistance around doing, like meditation, if we feel that we don't have time or whatever. There was something that you said that I really liked, however, which was meditating like a minimalist and going deeper than ever before. What is meditation or meditating like a minimalist?
Well, one of the reasons why people have a difficult time meditating is because they're just doing too much. They're doing way more than is necessary in order to have a delightful experience. And so when I talk about meditating like a minimalist, what I'm referring to is removing things from the practice, things that you may think are necessary for the practice, such as sitting with your back straight. Remove that from the equation. Sit with your back supported comfortably and trying to hold your thumb and index finger together. Remove that. Sitting with your palms facing up. Remove that. Sitting with your legs crossed. Remove that. Trying to focus on anything. Remove that. Trying to breathe in a certain way. Remove that. And you start stripping all these things away until it's just you just sitting there comfortably, just being. You're not doing anything. You're just being. You're practicing pure being. And the need to control the mind, whether it's witnessing your thoughts like clouds passing in the sky or letting go of the stress or, you know, noticing what you're sensing in the moment, like all that is still you're doing. And so let's strip all that away and just see what's there when you're just practicing pure being. Now, I'm not saying this is the best way to meditate. I'm not saying this is the way you should meditate. I'm just offering this as a way of kind of easing into the practice in the least intimidating way. And then as a result, you can build upon that. If you wanted to add things to it later, you can do that, but at least you've established the habit, the daily practice habit, through doing less, doing least, and ultimately through doing nothing. And that takes some time. It takes a few months of sitting there every day for 10 minutes in order for your body to become addicted or dependent on the biochemicals that get released in meditation. And then after that, you don't have to kind of convince yourself every day that you have the time to meditate, even though your ego is trying to convince you you don't have the time, because all this stuff is happening on social media. You need to be aware of the news. You need to know what's going on in the gossip columns. And you know, those are very convincing sounding arguments that people are grappling with on a daily basis. And yeah, it takes some time to kind of overcome that and quiet those voices and turn up the volume on the still small voice of inner guidance that's saying, no, you want to sit down and meditate right now so that you can be a better human in those other 23 hours and 50 minutes of your day, a better driver, better communicator, better mother, better parent, better partner, better sibling, better friend, better neighbor, better community leader, better all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that betterness comes from being who we really are. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a Pema Chodron quote that I really love where she says, meditation is not about throwing ourselves away and becoming something else that's better, but accepting and befriending who we really are.
It's like, love that. For me, I love her so much.
I love her too. Yeah. When I'm not meditated, that it's not that when I meditate, I'm necessarily a better Ben, even though I am. It's that when I don't meditate, I'm not even Ben. I'm not even me. It's like something Marianne Williamson taught me a long time ago. She's been mentoring me for a long time. And one of the earliest things that she taught me was about before going to an event where she's speaking or teaching or presenting. I said, what's like your practice before you go on stage? She said, I just have to become Marianne Williamson. And so I think about that all the time. It's like, I start my day and I have to just like, remember Ben Decker mm-hmm. and be him. The triggered me, the reactive me, the all the grasping or the desperation, that's not even me anyway. Mm-hmm. It's so much of like the nervous system responding to like external demands. And it's like, I'm not all the crap that Instagram projected into my mind, even though plenty of it can be good and inspiring. I'm not what CNN has projected into my mind. I'm not what the outside influence, I already am inside here. I am something. And so through that meditation, we can actually become that. There's something about meditating like a minimalist that what I initially thought of right away was how when I first started meditating really seriously as an adult, because I did practice when I was younger, but when I started to have like my new relationship with it, I needed a lot. I was like a high needs meditator. I was like, everyone in the house needs to be quiet. I need to set my room up. I need to have my cushion. I need to be facing east. I need to have my little altar. I need to sage the space, have the candle, have the water on the altar, have my whole setup. And it was like, and in a lot of ways that was really beneficial to have the whole ritual aspect of it. But then also I found that over time, it wasn't this beautiful thing I was setting up. Over time, it became an anxiety creator because then I needed so much from everyone else. And then meditation became, for a while there, a channel through which I would express all of my neuroses. My need to control the environment, my need to control exactly what's going on, my need to determine all of the factors so that I could have the experience I want to have. Versus what I later learned was like the more authentic essence of meditation, which is less about transforming, which is what I always thought. There's this big talk about transformation. Less about transformation, more about acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what we're ultimately looking for is the ability to adapt to all situations. And sometimes adapting means removing yourself from the situation. It doesn't mean putting up with someone's BS or, you know, something that's happening around you that doesn't feel aligned to how you want to relate to that space. Naturally, we're going to be in situations like that, that we just don't feel like we're able to get out of. And that's what I talk about in the book, the freedom of choicelessness as a means of reminding ourselves, okay, if I've tried to get out of this thing and I can't get out, then evidently I need to be here right now. School is in session, and instead of sitting there critiquing and criticizing everybody, let me see what I can learn from this experience. I'm being shown something, and maybe the thing I'm being shown is that, oh, I missed the opportunity to establish my boundaries earlier. Now I'm trapped in this situation for however long. And so this is going to be a really good refresher course in what it means to have healthy boundaries. So I don't have, because what we'll do is we'll wait until things get toxic to try to like establish boundaries. And then the boundary sounds punitive. It sounds like a punishment. And mm-hmm. people get defensive. And all that indicates is that we waited too long to talk about our boundaries. And if we get into the place where we can normalize establishing healthier boundaries earlier on, it's just going to sound like what it is, a healthy boundary, as opposed to a punishment, you know, and that could be a lesson. That's just one example of a lesson we could be learning from that situation. But you won't see the lesson if you're still focused on what's not happening. You have to really get present to what is happening. And then like one of those magic eye puzzles, the lesson will appear out of the maze, out of the pattern. And you'll be probably the only one that sees it. Like, oh my God, this is what this experience is all about. And then the experience becomes really fascinating and interesting because you can start connecting dots with that lesson and other things that are happening around. Oh, it's also connected to this and it's also connected to that. And then, you know, you find that because you were present to it, you can put yourself in the right place at the right time, more often than not, beyond that situation.
Yeah, it's like you mentioned meditation as a means to improve your intuition or your heart's voice. When you start to have a better relationship with your intuition, certain things you see a mile away that you didn't notice before, you know, and it's almost like I heard, are you familiar with Dr. Pillai's work? He's a Vedic doctor in San Diego. He's amazing. One of the things that he taught at a conference I went to was about time. And in meditation, how our relationship to time can begin to change. And one of the things that I appreciated he said was about ascended masters, this idea of you know, like the Mahasiddhas or the very highly practiced, highly realized yogis and Buddhas. And he said the thing with advanced practitioners is they live in compressed time. So for someone who's very, very present, there's a lot more time available to you, which is, I think, where the meaning of that quote that we mentioned earlier, where, you know, if you can't meditate for 10 minutes, you should meditate for an hour. It's really this idea that like, part of why you don't have any time is because you're doing too much and you're spread so thin. I read an article recently called The Myth of Multitasking. It's like sometimes you can get into a rhythm and you've got a couple things going on at once and it works out. But other times you're multitasking and none of them actually got done well. None of those tasks that you were doing at the same time, you know, were executed as well as if you had created the space to focus on each one individually.
Yeah, time is definitely not our most valuable asset. Presence is, because time is subjective. If you're not present, the time will go by faster and you won't remember any of it. And it'll just seem like you wake up one day and 5 years have passed. But if you're present, then again, you're engaging in those moments and you may not have as much, quote, free time as the next person, but the quality of your time is going to be through the roof compared to the person with all the free time, but no presence, where they're just squandering their time away. So instead of striving for more time or to buy back your time, I'm not saying that you know, you shouldn't do that, but you want to put as much energy into cultivating presence. And of course, you can do that through your inner work as well. And then you'll find that time slows down and you'll have more profound moments, even again, in otherwise what people would consider to be throwaway moments in traffic, in line at stores, in the post office, in the DMV. You're that person in there who's completely fascinated. And again, not in an annoying way, but just in an interested way. You're just interested. You're just interested in things. You're curious. You're noticing things. You're talking to people that you may have otherwise never spoken with. And you just don't know what's going to come from all that awareness.
Yeah, there's something that's coming to mind about, you know, when you're when you are in those places, it kind of reminds me, it's like when you're in the DMV, it's almost like for a moment, you may as well be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like finding the appreciation for the boundaries that your life has created around you. Like you were talking about your family members who had time incarcerated, you know, it's like you can sit there and be miserable and you would have every right to be totally miserable in a lot of circumstances. And a lot of people would be like, yeah, of course you're miserable. I would be miserable too. But there is something almost supernatural that occurs when you do have that perspective shift where you can look at your circumstances and say, okay, so here's what I'm really dealing with. And the perspective shift is that magic eye moment. I've always been good at those magic eye things. I get them right away. I like just blink and open and they're there. You know, I wish I could do that in all the circumstances in my life and immediately see it. I think I might be better than I used to be, but I really love what you're saying about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yeah, there's something else. What were you going to say?
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I appreciated something else I noticed in your book. I was wondering if you'd like to talk about it. It was a French word. I don't think I remember.
Flaneuring.
Yes, that one. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I've always been, not always, but recently in the last several years, I've become a big walker. And I started tracking my steps on my smartwatch. And then I became addicted to getting a certain number of steps every day.
Okay, what's your number? What's your goal every day?
My goal is, I'm like between 13 and 16,000 steps a day.
Wow, that's good. I'm at 10,000 and I'm so happy with it. It's like way higher than what I was getting.
You know? When I wasn't tracking it at all, I was probably at 3,000, 4,000 steps a day. Then I started tracking it and I started striving for 10,000, which depending on where you are, that's a stretch, man. If you're in LA getting 10,000 steps, you have to really be intentional about doing that, oddly enough. So I would like,
and if you're in the jungle, the 10,000 steps in the jungle is sort of like, is there a snake over there? What was that sound?
Yeah, exactly. So okay, flaneuring. So here in Mexico City, I was hanging out with a friend who's a city. She works in city planning. We were walking. She was going to take me for a walk just to observe the city planning that she works on. And she said, do you know, I was telling her about my love of walking. She goes, well, do you know about flaneuring? I was like, no, I never heard of this term before. And she told me about it. And it's an 18th century term, French term for aimless walking, which essentially is what I like to do, is wander around with no particular destination in mind for the sake of just being immersed in the environment. So if you're in a walking city like a Paris or a London or a Mexico City or New York, or I wouldn't consider LA a walking city. Some of the areas are like Venice could be a walking area, but it's just that moment where you just go out and you don't really, I mean, you know, you're not going to be out forever, but you don't have a specific destination. You're just going out just to go out and just see what you can see and just explore and get lost and find, you know, little charming nooks and crannies and cafes and shops and things like that. And so that's what flaneuring is. And in the process of flaneuring, you notice things about your neighborhood. You're engaging in more of a meditative approach to walking. You're not really, you know, you're not like super focused on getting to a certain number of steps necessarily. And you're getting the exercise of the movement and all the things that come with that. So again, it's the idea of doing more with less. You're just walking, but you're also bringing more of an intention to it of not trying to get somewhere, not being in too much of a hurry. And the true flaneurs, even they would walk by themselves. They wouldn't walk with someone else because then they would get distracted and they wouldn't notice as much about the environment if they were lost in a conversation with someone else. And they certainly wouldn't do it while they were under the influence of anything, because that would also rob them of their present moment awareness. So yeah, we're bringing back flaneuring through travel light and spiritual minimalism. And we want to start a movement again.
Yeah, I love that. There's so much interesting synchronicity for me in this conversation, because I just made my big move I just trimmed back everything. I'm traveling light, baby. You're inspiring me to like, maybe I don't need to bring my custom made Ouija board, my solid wood air, like laser engraved Ouija board with me everywhere I go. You know, there's a couple other things maybe that are extra that I could probably scale back on. So I'm definitely inspired by that. There was one more thing that I thought was kind of interesting. First of all, I love Travel Light. It's beautiful. It's illustrated beautifully. I've loved all of your books. I'm really excited for this one. May it be a New York Times bestseller. Bless it up. This is a great gift book. I'm excited. I really want it to do well. I love your work. I think you have a lot of integrity in what you do. So I'm really excited about that. There was one more thing that I had so much resistance to when I saw it. And I'm a world traveler. Okay. Just in the last year, Nepal, Malaysia, Bali, Costa Rica, Mexico, bunch of places all over the US, plenty of remote places actually in the US.
I'm trying to see if I can guess what it is, but I'm having a hard time guessing. Anyways, go ahead.
Washing your clothes. Every time I go to a new place, I'm like, I like find my gym and I find my laundry service and I find my food. So laundry service is always one of the things. But when I saw washing your own clothes, it's funny because Saw and his sister Moon, when we were in Nepal together, they washed their clothes in the sink at the monastery that we were in. And I was like, I'm hiring laundry service. Thank you very much. But yeah, talk to me about that.
That was a big game changer for me, man, learning how to hand wash my clothes. What I realized is that when I actually tried it, and I went on YouTube and looked up like a few tutorial videos, how to hand wash your clothes. Because I've tried it before and it took forever for the clothes to dry. And I didn't know how to do it properly. But I learned how to properly do it so that I could literally take my clothes off at like 10 o'clock at night, wash them in the sink. The whole thing would take like 3 to 5 minutes, put them up to dry. They'd be dry by the morning. And so, and they'd be fresher than they were if I were to put them in a machine. So it's all about technique. And, you know, what you do is you just turn it into a little meditation. You just turn it into a little, and guess what? Just like I was talking about how the table collecting dust probably isn't as happy as it would be if it was being used properly. I think your clothes are the same way. I think clothes appreciate the hand wash over the machine, just being tossed in some machine and just being thrown around in the machine. And, you know, it's just not that your clothes aren't sentient. Everything is sentient. That's that's where I'm approaching all of this. Is if everything is sentient, that means everything can respond to its environment. And I believe that your clothes will treat you better if you treat them better. Absolutely. So just having that in mind as I'm hand washing, and then, you know, you're air drying them essentially. So they have that freshness of being air dried. And yeah, it's just a really beautiful process. Now, it doesn't mean that I do this every night. I have a washing machine in my Airbnb that I use, you know, when I need to wash clothes. But when I'm on the road, it gives you a lot more freedom because you have a lot more space. You don't have to take as many things, knowing that you're going to be hand washing your clothes on a nightly basis. And then that way, if something happens to your luggage, if something gets stolen or lost, you know, I don't think about it for 2 seconds because I know that I'm good. I'm good. I don't have to run out to some store and get stuff. I'm good. I can keep myself nice and fresh on a day-to-day basis. I'm like those you know, tribal people that live in the Amazon that I used to see on National Geographic. They would go into the jungle just with a spear and come back 2 days later with a whole basket full of fruit and stuff they found in the forest. And that's because they're self-sufficient. They're so self-sufficient in that way. And this was what spiritual minimalism was all about, is becoming more and more self-sufficient as well. So
I love that. Self-sufficiency.
Do more with less.
Self-sufficiency, do more with less, baby. Okay. Travel Light. It's available everywhere. Go buy it. Is it on audiobook?
I read the audiobook.
Yes.
And that was a very beautiful experience as well. So I highly recommend that. But as you mentioned, there's some beautiful illustrations in the book, which it's always torn.
Mm-hmm. It's always both. You got to just do both. Get the book and the audiobook. And this is a great book for friends. If you've got friends that you do book clubs with, or friends that your accountability partners, 12-step buddies, sponsees, stuff like that. This is a great gift, great book to do with friends. Also great introspective personal book. Highly recommend it. Travel Light, all the links in the show notes. Thank you, Light.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, and let's do it every single time you do anything. I'm here for it. I love everything you have to say, and I'm super grateful. And all your links, your social media links, will also be in the show notes for this.
Thanks, bro.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. All right, talk soon. Let's do it again.
Hey, it's Ben Decker, and I just have to thank you again for listening to the Modern Spirituality Podcast. For information on anything mentioned here, you can check out the show notes below. You can also get in touch with me via twitter.com/BenDecker, instagram.com/BenjaminWDecker, or email me at BenDecker@ModernSpiritualityPodcast.com. It really does mean so much to me that you're here with me on the modern spirituality journey. I'm genuinely super excited about what I've got planned for these next few episodes. So really make sure to subscribe to the Modern Spirituality Podcast so you can get in on what I've got coming up. And if this is resonating for you, if anything here helped or inspired or entertained you at all, please, please do rate this podcast and leave me a review. It means so much more than you might realize. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again.